Okay, so the first thing I want to say is I've never given a talk when I couldn't see to whom I'm giving the talk. So it's a little weird, but we'll see how it goes. Okay, so what I want to do is share with you the second of the long discourses, the discourse on the fruits of the spiritual life. And one of the things that I learned was that it's probably a good idea to not talk to people who haven't been recently meditating. So, since this is your usual custom, we're going to have meditation for the next 25 minutes. So, in order to start, please settle yourself into a nice, comfortable posture. It's more important to feel comfortable than to look good. You want to find a position that you can maintain for the next 25 minutes without having to move. And it's comfortable. And once you're settled, close your eyes and then put your attention on the tactile sensations of breathing. If you can notice the tactile sensations at your nostrils or just a little ways inside, or perhaps in the area between your nose and your upper lip, that's an excellent place to work. And you're just noticing the touch of the air as it comes in and goes out. Or perhaps you notice the rise and fall of your belly or the rise and fall of your chest. Pick whichever one of these feels most natural to you. And if you're unsure, pick your nostrils and just simply put your attention on the rise and fall of your breathing. Now, it's quite likely that eventually you become distracted from your breathing. It's not a big deal. This is who we are. We're the progeny of creatures that had to pay attention to their environment. So when you notice you've become distracted, it can be helpful to label the distraction, planning, worrying, wanting, nonsense. The first label that comes to mind is always correct. Spend zero energy trying to get the perfect label. And then, very important, relax and bring your attention back to your breathing. You want to, as much as possible, just be paying attention to your uncontrolled breathing. Meditation is about noticing, not about doing anything. And so you're just noticing your natural, uncontrolled breathing. the attitude to have when you're meditating is one of relaxed diligence. You're not trying to force your mind to stay on the breathing. You're relaxing into the breath, and you're being diligent about noticing the distractions. And then, when you're distracted, label the distraction, relax, and come on back. If you put a little fake wispy Buddha smile on your face, that will be helpful. You can just relax into that smile. Yeah, it may feel fake at first, but if you leave it there long enough and get concentrated enough, it'll become a genuine smile. Smiling generates endorphins. Endorphins make you feel good. Meditation can make you feel good. Enjoy. So I want to tell you the sutta. I'm going to give you my version, of course. You should probably read the real version after we finish up here. I'll put a link in the chat towards the end of this so you can find a good translation by Bhikkhu Bodhi. This sutta is entitled The Fruits of the Spiritual Life, and it's a great example of what is known as the gradual training. It's called gradual training because each part of the training builds on the next one, just like going up a flight of stairs builds on the previous one. And this is the curriculum for the monks and nuns. This is, well, what you practiced if you wanted to become fully awakened in the Buddhist dispensation. The Buddha's path consisted primarily of three things: sila, samadhi, and panya, morality, concentration, and wisdom. So while you listen to the sutta, see if you can pick out the three aspects of the path: the morality part, the concentration part, and the wisdom part. So I'll give you what I got. Thus have I heard. Once the Blessed One was living in Jivaka's mango grove with a company of 1,250 monks just outside the city of Rajagaha. Now, Jivaka, who had given the mango grove to the Buddha to use as a monastery, was the royal physician in the court of King Ajatasattu, king of Magadha. And on the night of our sutta, it was the full moon, and King Ajatasattu was sitting on the upper terrace of his palace, surrounded by his ministers and other members of his court. And when the moon rose, King Ajatasattu uttered a joyful exclamation. Oh, what a beautiful night. Oh, what a wondrous night. Oh, what an auspicious night. Perhaps we could visit some recluse or Brahmin who could bring some peace to my mind. You see, King Ajatasattu did not have a peaceful mind. This was because he had killed his father, good King Bimbisara. King Bimbisara actually met Siddhartha Gautama before he became the Buddha. The story goes that King Bimbisara was looking out of one of the upper windows of his palace, and he saw this recluse going on alms round down below. But he had a regal bearing. He was different. So the king called one of his ministers over and said, follow that recluse, see where he goes, report back to me. So three guys went out and followed Siddhartha Gautama back to Vulture's Peak, which is a mountain outside of Rajagaha. It's studded with caves, so it's a great place if you're a meditator to go off and meditate. And so while two of the guys kept an eye on where Siddhartha Gautama was, one went back, told King Bimbisara, and King Bimbisara rode his chariot out as far as he could and then climbed up the mountain and introduced himself to Siddhartha Gautama, found out who Siddhartha was, and wound up offering him a ministerial position in the kingdom of Rajagaha. But Siddhartha Gautama wasn't interested in politics. He wanted to find out what to do about old age, sickness, and death, so he politely declined. But King Bimbisara got him to promise that if he found out, he'd come back and tell the king. And sure enough, 3 years after his awakening, the Buddha returned to Rajagaha and gave a discourse to King Bimbisara. And King Bimbisara was established in the fruit of stream entry, meaning he has attained the first level of awakening. And he became a great supporter of the Buddha. But King Bimbisara had a son, Prince Ajatasattu, and Prince Ajatasattu was an ambitious man. He grew weary of waiting for his father to die and decided to take matters into his own hands. he strapped a dagger to his thigh and went sneaking into the king's private quarters and was immediately apprehended by the guards. They hauled him up before the king and they said, "Great king, we found your son sneaking into your private quarters and he had this dagger strapped to his thigh." "Son, why were you sneaking into my private quarters with a dagger strapped to your thigh?" "I was going to kill you, Dad." "Why do you want to kill me?" "I want your kingdom." "Why didn't you just say so? Here, you can be king." And he made him king right on the spot. King Bimbisara wanted to go pursue the spiritual path full time, so he was quite happy to turn it over to his son. So Prince Ajatasattu got to be King Ajatasattu. But he grew worried that his father was going to get bored with all that meditation stuff and want his kingdom back. So he ordered his father thrown in the dungeon. He didn't really want to order his father killed. He just cut off all his food. He did allow one visitor, the queen. The queen was very shrewd. When she went to see her husband, she would smear her body with honey, and the king could live by licking it off. When King Bimbisara wasn't dying, King Ajatasattu went to see him. "Dad, how come you're not dead yet?" "Oh, when your mother comes to visit, she smears her body with honey and I live by licking it off." End of visits from the queen. But still, King Bimbisara wasn't dying, so King Ajatasattu ordered him tortured. And during the torturing, he died. The commentaries say that two messages arrived at the palace simultaneously. First message was that a son had been born to King Ajatasattu's queen, and the king for the first time understood a father's love for his son. And he said to his men, "Release my father from prison." And they gave him the second message, which was that his father was dead. And so from that point on, King Ajatasattu was troubled with terrible nightmares. He would no sooner fall asleep than he'd wake up screaming, and his servants would rush in. Great king, are you all right?" "I'm fine, I'm fine, go away, go away." And he'd fall back to sleep and have another nightmare. So on the full moon night, he doesn't want to go to sleep. And if the king can't sleep, nobody gets to sleep. So when he's up there on the upper terrace of his palace, all the ministers and Jivaka and everybody else from the courts hanging out with him, and he utters his joyful exclamation about wanting to visit some recluse or Brahmin that could bring some peace to his mind. And one of the ministers piped up and said, "There's Purana Kasapa. He's long gone forth. He's esteemed as holy. He has many followers. He's in the last stage of his life. You should visit him. Perhaps he can bring some peace to your mind." The king didn't say anything. Another minister piped up, "There's Makali Gosala. He's long gone forth. He has many followers." You get the picture. Each of the ministers piped up with his recluse or Brahmin, and the king said nothing, no matter what anybody suggested. Finally, the king turns to Jivaka and says, "Jivaka, you know any recluse or Brahmin we might visit?" "Great king, the Buddha, the perfectly awakened one, is dwelling in my mango grove with a company of 1,250 bhikkhus. He teaches the Dhamma, which is good in the beginning, good in the middle, good in the end. You should visit the Buddha. Perhaps he can bring some peace to your mind." "Prepare the elephant vehicles, Jivaka." So Jivaka goes running down from the upper terrace of the palace to the stables below. And he has 500 female elephants saddled up, along with the king's royal bull elephant. And then he runs back up to the upper terrace of the palace and says, "Great king, the elephant vehicles are prepared. Do as you see fit." And so the king had 500 women of the court seated one each on the 500 female elephants. And then the king and Jivaka mounted up on the royal tusker, and they went forth in full royal splendor with torchbearers going before. Must have been quite a sight on that full moon night. They rode out of the palace and then through the city of New Rajagaha and then through the old city and out the south gate and hung a left and headed towards the mango grove. And when they got near the mango grove, well, it was quiet. It was a little too quiet. Jivaka, are you betraying me? Are you turning me over to my enemies? No, great king. Why would you think that? You said there's 1,250 people in this grove. I don't hear a sound. They're probably all meditating, great king. Look, you can see lights in the pavilion hall. Go forward, great king. Go forward. So they went as far as they could go on the elephants, and they dismounted. And the king and Jivaka and all the women of the court went up to the pavilion hall. And the king's looking around, checking out what's going on. Yeah, pretty nice, peaceful, quiet. Which one's the Buddha? He's the one sitting at the back facing everybody else. And so the king makes his way up to near where the Buddha is. And finally he says, oh, if only my son, the prince, could experience peace, such as the company of bhikkhus experiences. And the Buddha hears him and says, great king, do your thoughts follow your affection? Yes, yes, indeed. I love my son very much, and it would be wonderful if he could experience peace, such as the Sangha of bhikkhus experiences. And then the king saluted the Buddha, saluted the monks, and sat down to one side. Sitting there, he said, venerable sir, may I ask you a question? Certainly, great king, ask whatever you wish. Venerable sir, in my kingdom, there are people who practice many different crafts. There are elephant trainers, horse trainers, there are archers, spearmen, there are swordsmen, there are chainmail warriors, there are camp marshals, there are commandos, there are bakers, weavers, farmers, basket makers, street sweepers, barbers, accountants, statisticians. Each of them practices their craft, and it's possible to see here and now some fruit of their labor. Venerable sir, can you point out any fruit of the spiritual life that's visible here and now? Great king, have you ever asked this question of any other recluse or Brahmin? Well, yes, actually I have. I've asked a half a dozen of them this very question, but they just preached their doctrine at me and never really got around to answering the question. It was like asking for a mango and being given a breadfruit. Not very appetizing. But I never said anything. I just went away quietly. So once again, I ask you, can you point out any fruits of the spiritual life visible here and now? Great king, I will ask you a question. Answer as you see fit. Suppose in your palace there's a slave, a workman, who arises before you each morning, waits on you hand and foot, sees that all of your needs are met, doesn't go to bed until after you go to bed. Suppose this slave were to think, it is wonderful, it is marvelous, the destiny of meritorious deeds. For this king Adityasattu is a man and I am a man. And yet he enjoys the five strands of sense pleasures as though he were a god, while I wait on him hand and foot from morning to night. Perhaps I too should do meritorious deeds. Great king, at some point in the future, suppose this slave were to shave off his hair and beard, put on the ochre robe, and go forth from the home life to the homeless life. Upon learning of this, would you send your soldier saying, make that man come back and be my slave? Oh, no, venerable sir. We would rise up before him. We would prepare a seat. We would see to his food, clothing, shelter, and medicinal requirements. We would provide for him righteous protection. Great king, is this not a fruit of the spiritual life visible here and now? Yes, yes, I guess it is, venerable sir. Venerable sir, can you point out any other fruit of the spiritual life that's visible here and now? I'll ask you a question, great king. Answer as you see fit. Suppose in your kingdom there's a farmer who toils in his fields from morning to night. And when it's harvest time, well, he winds up paying a large portion of his harvest as taxes to support the royal treasury. Suppose this farmer were to grow weary of paying taxes. Suppose he were to think, it is wonderful, it is marvelous, the destiny of meritorious deeds. For this King Ajatasattu is a man and I am a man, and yet he enjoys the five strands of sense pleasures as though he were a god. Well, I toil in my fields from morning to night and wind up paying a large portion of my harvest as taxes. Perhaps I too should do meritorious deeds. Great King, suppose this man were to shave off his hair and beard, put on the ochre robe, and go forth from the home life to the homeless life. Upon learning of this, would you send your soldier saying, make that man come back and be a farmer so he can support the royal treasury? Oh, no, venerable sir. We would rise up before him. We would prepare a seat. We would see to his food, clothing, shelter, and medicinal requirements. We would provide for him righteous protection. Great King, is this not also a fruit of the spiritual life visible here and now? Yes. Venerable sir, it is. But can you point out any fruit of the spiritual life that's more wondrous and more impressive than these and visible here and now? Listen, great King, and pay attention. A Tathagata arises in this world, a fully awakened Buddha who teaches the Dhamma, which is good in the beginning, good in the middle, good in the end. A householder, a householder's child, or some other person hears the Dhamma and gains faith and thinks, household life is crowded and dusty. Going forth is free like the air. And then this householder, a householder's child, or some other person shaves off hair and beard, puts on the ochre robe, and joins the Tathagata's order. Great King, when one joins the Tathagata's order, one lives restrained by the precepts, the rules of behavior. The first of these precepts, Great King, is I undertake the training to refrain from killing living beings. The second of these rules, Great King, is I undertake the training to refrain from taking that which is not given. There are many rules, Great King. We're celibate. We tell the truth. We don't engage in divisive speech. We don't use harsh language. We don't engage in gossip or idle chatter. We don't take intoxicants. We only eat in one part of the day. We don't adorn ourselves with perfumes or garlands. We don't go visit singing and dancing shows. We don't handle money. There are many rules, Great King. By keeping these rules, it makes it possible to practice the spiritual life. In particular, it makes it possible to live with the senses guarded. Upon seeing a sight with the eye, one does not grasp at the signs or secondary characteristics, lest evil, unwholesome states, such as covetousness or grief, overcome one. When hearing a sound with the ear, smelling a smell with the nose, tasting a taste with the tongue, touching a texture with the body, or thinking a thought with the mind, one does not grasp at the signs or secondary characteristics, lest evil, unwholesome states overcome one. By living with our senses restrained, it makes it possible to be mindful of all that we do. Mindful when going forward, mindful when coming back. Mindful when looking forward, mindful when looking back. Mindful when getting dressed, mindful when going on alms round. Mindful when eating, chewing, savoring, and swallowing. Mindful when going to the toilet. Mindful when walking, standing, sitting, and lying down. Mindful when speaking and keeping silent. Mindful when falling asleep. And mindful when waking up. Also, Great King, we have very few needs. We're content with little. All we need is food, clothing, shelter, medicine if we're ill. This leaves us free to go wherever we want, like a bird on the wing. With this noble precepts, this noble guarding of the senses, this noble mindfulness, and this noble contentment with little, it makes it possible to do the work of a recluse. Upon returning from alms round, having eaten the midday meal, one resorts to a secluded dwelling, the forest, the root of a tree, a heap of straw, a charnel ground, the open air. One sits down cross-legged, holds one's body erect, and sets up mindfulness before oneself. Great King, when meditating, there are five states of mind that could arise that hinder progress on the spiritual path. The first of these is the desire for sensual gratification. Since desire is like being in debt, if someone is in debt, they must continually work to pay back that debt. It's the same with sense desire. There is no sense desire that is ultimately satisfying. A really nice, satisfied sense desire only leads to more sense desire. But if someone were in debt and were able to pay back that debt, they would rejoice and become glad. If someone can overcome sense desire, even temporarily, one rejoices and becomes glad. The second of these hindrances, Great King, is ill will and hatred. Ill will and hatred is like being physically ill. If someone is physically ill, they don't feel well, they're hot, they can't think straight, they can't do what they want to do. If someone is overcome with ill will and hatred, they don't feel well, they're hot, they can't think straight, they can't do what they want to do. But if someone who is ill were to take medicine and regain their health, they would rejoice and become glad. In the same way, if one can overcome ill will and hatred, even temporarily, one rejoices and becomes glad. The third of these hindrances, Great King, is sloth and torpor. Sloth and torpor is like being in prison. If someone is in prison, they just sit there, missing out on all the good things of life. If someone is overcome with sloth and torpor, they just sit there, missing out on all the good things of the spiritual life. But if a prisoner were to gain his freedom, he would rejoice and become glad. In the same way, if someone can overcome sloth and torpor, even temporarily, they rejoice and become glad. The fourth of these hindrances, Great King, is restlessness and remorse. Restlessness and remorse is like being a slave. A slave is always busy. The master commands, go there, do that, come here, do this. But the slave is always doing just what the master commands and not getting to do what the slave would like to do. It's the same with restlessness and remorse. One's mind is all over the place. One's body can't sit still. Very busy, but nothing being accomplished. But if a slave were to gain his freedom, he would rejoice and become glad. In the same way, if one can overcome restlessness and remorse, even temporarily, one rejoices and becomes glad. The fifth of these hindrances, Great King, is skeptical doubt. Skeptical doubt is like being on a perilous desert journey where bandits abound and provisions are scarce. First, one thinks to go this way, but no, there are sure to be bandits. Better to go this way, but there won't be any water. One does more starting and stopping than actual progressing. It's the same with skeptical doubt. First, one tries this practice, but yeah, no real feedback that it's working. So they try another practice. Hey, there's more starting and stopping than actual progressing. But if someone on a perilous desert journey were to arrive at a place of safety, they would rejoice and become glad. In the same way, if one can overcome skeptical doubt, one rejoices and becomes glad. Great King, when one sees that these five hindrances are not abandoned, one regards that as being in debt, as being ill, as being in prison, as being a slave, as a desert road. But when one sees that these five hindrances have been abandoned, one regards that as freedom from debt, as good health, as release from prison, as freedom from slavery, as a place of safety. Thus secluded from sense desire, secluded from unwholesome states of mind, one enters and dwells in the first jhana, which is with thinking and examining, and contains rapture and happiness born of seclusion. One drenches deep, saturates, and suffuses one's body with the rapture and happiness born of seclusion. So there is no part of one's body not filled with rapture and happiness. Great King, imagine a skilled bath attendant or his apprentice taking a metal basin and then pouring in soap flakes and then pouring in just the right amount of water and then mixing the soap flakes until they have a homogeneous ball of soap. In the same way, one drenches deep, saturates, and suffuses one's body with the rapture and happiness born of seclusion. So there is no part of one's body not filled with rapture and happiness. Great King, this is the fruit of the spiritual life, visible here and now, and more wondrous and more sublime than the previous. Further, Great King, with the subsiding of thinking and examining, and by gaining inner tranquility and unification of mind, one enters and dwells in the second jhana, which is without thinking and examining, and contains rapture and happiness born of concentration. One drenches deep, saturates, and suffuses one's body with the rapture and happiness born of concentration. So there is no part of one's body not filled with rapture and happiness. Great King, imagine a lake far up in the mountains with no streams coming in from the east, the west, the north, or the south, not even showers of rain from time to time. And yet, at the bottom of the lake, there's a spring of cool, clear water. That cool, clear water would totally permeate the lake, so there would be no part of that lake not touched by the cool, clear water. In the same way, Great King, one changes deep, saturates, and suffuses one's body with the rapture and happiness born of concentration, so there is no part of one's body not filled with rapture and happiness. Great King, this too is a fruit of the spiritual life, visible here and now, and more wondrous and more sublime than the previous. Further, Great King, with the fading away of rapture, by remaining imperturbable, mindful, and clearly aware, one experiences the third jhana, of which the noble ones declare, happy is one who is equanimous and mindful, and one experiences happiness free from rapture. One drenches deep, saturates, and suffuses one's body with this happiness free from rapture, so there is no part of one's body not filled with happiness. Great King, imagine a lotus pond where there grow blue, white, or red lotuses that grow up out of the mud but do not come above the surface of the water. They would lead their whole lives filled with water from their tips to their roots. In the same way, one drenches deep, saturates, and suffuses one's body with a happiness free from rapture, so there is no part of one's body not filled with happiness. Great King, this too is a fruit of the spiritual life, visible here and now, and more wondrous and more sublime than the previous. Further, Great King, with the passing of pleasure and pain, and with the previous passing of joy and grief, one enters and remains in the fourth jhana, a state beyond pleasure and pain that contains mindfulness fully purified by equanimity. One sits suffusing one's body with a pure, bright mind, so there is no part of one's body not suffused by the pure, bright mind. Great King, imagine a man covered from the head down by a white cloth so that his whole body was suffused with a white cloth. In the same way, one sits suffusing one's body with a pure, bright mind, so there is no part of one's body not suffused by the pure, bright mind. Great King, this too is a fruit of the spiritual life, visible here and now, and more wondrous and more sublime than the previous. Further, Great King, with a mind thus concentrated, clear, sharp, bright, malleable, wieldy, and given to imperturbability, one can direct and incline it to knowing and seeing. One can understand, this is my body, made of material form, composed of the four great elements, born of mother and father, fed on rice and gruel, impermanent, subject to rubbing and pressing, to dissolution and dispersion. And this is my consciousness, which is bound up with it and supported by it. Great King, insights into the nature of reality such as these are also fruits of the spiritual life, visible here and now, and more wondrous and more sublime than the previous. Further, great king, with a mind still concentrated, clear, sharp, bright, malleable, wieldy, and given to imperturbability, one can practice the various psychic powers. One can make a mind-made body. One can wield the various supernormal powers like walking on water, diving into the earth, passing through walls and ramparts unimpeded, appearing and disappearing at will, being one, becoming many, being many, becoming one, flying cross-legged through the sky as though one were a bird, stroking the sun and the moon, wielding mastery over the body as far as the Brahma realms. One can also hear sounds at a great distance. One can know the minds of others. One can remember past lives. One can see beings passing away and re-arising according to their karma. Great king, these psychic powers are also fruits of the spiritual life, visible here and now, and more wondrous and more sublime than the previous. Further, great king, with a mind thus concentrated, clear, sharp, bright, malleable, wieldy, given to imperturbability, one can overcome the asavas, the intoxicants. One can understand this is dukkha. This is the origin of dukkha. This is cessation of dukkha. And this is the path of practice that leads to the cessation of dukkha. And one can understand these are the asavas, the intoxicants. This is the origin of the asavas. This is the cessation of the asavas. And this is the path of practice that leads to the cessation of the asavas. And one can make an end to the intoxicant of sense desire, the intoxicant of becoming, and the intoxicant of ignorance. And in so doing, one also makes a total end to all dukkha. Great king, this too is a fruit of the spiritual life, visible here and now, and more wondrous and more sublime than the previous. And furthermore, great king, there is no fruit of the spiritual life more wondrous and more sublime than this. The king was impressed. Wonderful, marvelous. It's like pointing out the way to one who is lost. It's like revealing something that's hidden. It's like bringing a light into a room where it was dark, and so that people who have eyes can see. I go for refuge to the Buddha and to the Dharma and to the Bhikkhu Sangha. May the Buddha please consider me a lay follower from this day forth. Then King Ajatasattu got all shamefaced, and finally he blurted out, "Venerable sir, a transgression overcame me in that for the sake of rulership, I killed my father, a righteous man and a righteous king." "Indeed, great king, a transgression did overcome you in that you killed your father, a righteous man and a righteous king. But it is good that you acknowledge this transgression for the sake of your restraint in the future." And then King Ajatasattu said, "We must be going. We have many things to do." "Do as you see fit, great king." So the king saluted the Buddha, saluted the monks, circumambulated the Buddha, and then keeping the Buddha on his right, he and Jivaka and all the women from the court went back to where the elephants were parked, mounted up, and rode back to the palace. Not long after the king and everyone had departed, the Buddha said to the monks, "This king has ruined himself. This king has destroyed himself. If he had not killed his father, a righteous man and a righteous king, then the stainless eye of Dhamma would have opened in him tonight, and he would have attained the first level of awakening. But this king has ruined himself." And the monks were very pleased with all that the Buddha had taught. Now, the sutta ends here, but the commentaries go on to say that King Ajatasattu did indeed become a great protector of the Dharma. And after the Buddha's death, 3 months afterwards, it was the first great council of arhats, which was held in a cave just outside the city of Rajagaha. Obviously, these 500 fully enlightened disciples of the Buddha felt that they were safe under the protection of King Ajatasattu. But King Ajatasattu was an ambitious man, and after the Buddha's death, he set out on wars of conquest and conquered all of the neighboring kingdoms and republics and built the nucleus of the first great Indian empire. But not all went well for King Ajatasattu. You see, his son killed him, and his grandson killed his son, and his great-grandson killed his grandson, and his great-great-grandson killed his great-grandson. And at that point, the people of Magadha said, enough of these father killers. They killed the last of the line and installed a new dynasty. Any questions? While you're thinking about questions, I will mention Donna again. Sangha Live is a really great resource. Only it takes money to run a really great resource. So, yeah, you can make a nice donation. This will help them out. Some of the money will come to me. And when it comes to me, well, maybe I can make a nice donation to something like relief for the people of Ukraine. There's 4 million refugees now. It's a really serious situation. And there's some organizations doing some great relief. So yeah, your Donna will go to a really good organization, Sangha Live, and I'll pass whatever comes to me along to other organizations that are doing great things. So, questions? I like this sutta because, as I said, it illustrates the main aspects of the path, sila, samadhi, and panya. The precepts, obviously, are sila, morality. If you're keeping the precepts, well, you're not causing harm. That's what morality is all about. And then it's debatable whether guarding the senses is part of concentration or part of morality. It's a concept, you know, doesn't really matter. But guard the senses. And then when you do that, it's much easier to be mindful. Mindfulness is a big deal these days. There's a lot more to mindfulness than just what's being taught in the secular area. And then, yeah, be content with little. We live on a limited planet. There's not a lot of stuff available for everyone. We're using up the resources faster than they can be replenished. Does this concept of karma set out here rely on the acceptance of reincarnation, or can it be seen to work its way through in this life? So karma to the Buddha meant action, right? That's what the word means. But in the context of spiritual action, he said, karma I declare, O monks, is intention. So karma is about, the teachings on karma are about paying attention to your intentions behind your actions. The results of karma, that word is vipaka, and it plays out either immediately or later or much later. And you don't need any reincarnation or rebirth for that to happen. Basically, you should pay attention to your intentions for everything you're going to do. Because whatever you do is going to change how the world unfolds. We don't get to change it in a big way. I mean, if you have the ability to change it in a big way, you've been falling down on the job. But we all have the ability to change it in a small way. And so, yeah, you change how the universe unfolds every time you act. Sometimes you get the result right away. Sometimes you get the result later. Sometimes it takes a while. But yeah, you don't need reincarnation. We're in this together. This is Buddha's teachings on not-self. And if you look at karma and its resultants from a not-self perspective, you realize, oh yeah, we're all in this together, and whatever I do is affecting everyone. There's another question for the number and the name of the sutta. The reference would be Digha Nikaya number 2. And the name of the sutta is The Fruits of the Spiritual Life, the Samanyapala Sutta. Can you please comment further about non-hindrance states in regular lay life and releasing thinking? Excuse me. So the Buddha suggested that the states we want to indulge in lay life and on the spiritual path are non-greed, non-hatred, and non-delusion. In other words, love, compassion, and wisdom. And so that's what we really want to work on. So the hindrances that are given are hindrances to your meditation practice. Yeah, they're hindrances to other things in your life as well. But in particular, they will prevent you from getting into the jhanas, the concentration states that are necessary. So we want to dismiss those states to the best of our ability. In the Satipatthana Sutta, in the fifth of the establishments of mindfulness, the five hindrances are given there. And one is to know that they're present and deal with them, get them to go away, and prevent them from coming back. And the opposite of that is the seven factors of awakening. In those states, you're to know if they're there. And if they're there, you are to encourage them, keep them around, bring them to perfection. And they are mindfulness, examination of phenomena, energy, PT, which I translated as rapture when I told the sutta, tranquility, concentration, and equanimity. So those are the states we want to practice. The way to practice those states, well, if you practice the jhanas, you get the PT, and you also get some tranquility once the PT calms down, and you get pretty concentrated. And by the time you get to the fourth jhana, you've got good equanimity. And then with your mind concentrated, clear, sharp, bright, malleable, wieldy, yeah, you can be really mindful. And you can examine reality and gain insight into what's going on, and that'll give you a lot of energy. And that energy you can use to continue your practice. So seven factors of awakening are a spiral that'll take you higher. So the non-hindrance states that you want to practice are the seven factors of awakening. The idea that the king might have reached the stage of enlightenment were it not for his past sin that he confessed and seemed to know was wrong doesn't seem very Buddhist to me. Can you explain why the sin of killing his father prevented enlightenment despite having taken refuge that night? Well, a couple things to mention. First off, the traditional way of saying is that there are five heinous crimes, and you commit any of those heinous crimes, and yeah, you punched your ticket to hell. But if you get to the first stage of awakening, you're guaranteed not to go to hell. So the orthodox way of interpreting this was because the king killed his father, he punched his ticket to hell, which prevented him from reaching the first stage of awakening. The five heinous crimes: killing your mother, killing your father, killing an arhat, attempting to kill a Buddha, creating a schism in the Sangha. But I think it's more that the Buddha recognized that King Ajatasattu wasn't interested in the spiritual path. He was so power hungry, he killed his own father, right? if he killed his own father, he wasn't going to practice. He wasn't going to do the things necessary to attain anything significant on the spiritual path. So that's what I would say the Buddha is recognizing. This guy killed his father. If he wasn't so blinded by his quest for power, he has the intelligence to understand what I said, and it could have led to an awakening experience. But because he's so bent on power that he would kill his father, it's not going to happen. How do I avoid becoming the king and destroying that which is most precious due to greed and distraction, inability to stay with spaciousness and love? It's very important that you know your state of mind. This is the third establishment of mindfulness. So you should be checking in and knowing your state of mind. The first three that are given in the description of the third establishment of mindfulness: a mind with greed, or a mind without greed, a mind with hatred, a mind without hatred, a mind with delusion, a mind without delusion. So, yeah, what's going on? Am I doing this out of greed? When I first started teaching, I went up to all the teachers that I really respected, and I said, give me some advice. I'm starting to teach. And several people said, always pay attention to your motivation behind everything you do. And that's been great advice, not only for teaching, but for my whole life. What is my motivation for what I'm doing? Am I trying to get something? Am I trying to help people out? What's going on here? And so, yeah, just checking in on your mind state. If you have a greedy mind state, maybe don't act from that. If you're distracted, yeah, try and get yourself a little more settled before, yeah, you try and do anything else. Please repeat the second benefits of the spiritual life. Okay, the whole list. If you're a slave, you get free. If you're a farmer, you don't have to farm your field. And then 1 Jhana, 2 Jhana, 3 Jhana, 4 Jhana. Insight into the nature of reality. Yeah, the supernormal powers, all that stuff. You can forget about that. It's probably going to be a distraction. And then the final one, overcoming the asavas. In other words, becoming fully awakened. So those are the benefits of the spiritual life. Someone in the chat put, I have a hard time following the jhanas in order. Hard to think it is linear like that. It's linear like that. The first one builds up a lot of excitement, which you then calm down. And then you calm it even further. And then you calm it still further. So it's very definitely going in that direction. It is linear. Now, people do stumble into these states out of order. But if you really want to get good at it, it's best to learn them in the order, because you can get into the first one and use the concentration of that one to get a really high quality second one. And having a high quality second one gives you a high quality third one, etc. Is it best to regard the jhanas as a useful description of states that may occur during meditation practice, or would you set out to practice them? Well, I stumbled into the first one, and then I went on my second retreat with Ayakema, and she said, I didn't know it was the jhana. She said, yeah, that's the first jhana. Here's how you do the second. And she taught me the jhanas. So practicing them turned out to be one of the best things I ever did, because once I learned what they were used for, basically a warm-up exercise for insight practice, the insights totally transformed my life. Would trying to practice them not set up an attachment to ideas of wanting to practice in a certain way, which would then be a hindrance? Actually, you do need to practice in a certain way. You know, just sitting down and doing whatever you feel like is probably not going to work. You really need to know what you're doing. One of the things that Ayakema said to me, is that you have such success on the spiritual path because you follow instructions. If you don't know what you're doing on the spiritual path, I mean, yeah, you're just liable to wander off and get lost. I don't know where you live, but I live in Oakland, California. All right, let's say I want to go to Seattle, but I don't know where Seattle is. So I just get in my car and I start driving around. What are the odds I'm going to wind up in Seattle? Not really good. You know, I sort of got to know where I'm going. What the Buddha taught on the spiritual path is that the jhanas are a really good way to concentrate your mind. If you're going to do the Sila Samadhi Panya thing, if you're really going to build a foundation of mindfulness and then concentrate your mind and examine reality, the jhanas are a really good way to examine, to get your mind in a state where it can examine reality better than anything else. They're not easy to learn, okay? But, you know, the Buddha taught an eightfold path, and the eighth fold on the eightfold path is right concentration, Sama Samadhi. And he defines right concentration as the four jhanas. Yeah, I wish they were easier to teach. I wish they were easier to learn. But it's worth the effort to see if it's something that works for you. If you get attached to them, just like if you get attached to anything else, it can be a problem. One of the things that I learned in teaching the jhanas was, yeah, people get attached to these states, but if I'll push them into doing insight practice post-jhana, the insights are so much more interesting that it dissolves their attachment to the jhanas. They just become a warm-up exercise. I mean, if you're a runner, before you run, okay, you go up to a telephone pole and you stretch your calves, right? Okay, do you get attached to stretching your calves? No, you got something better to do. Same thing with the jhanas. Asavas are floods, outflows, effluents, intoxicants. The original meaning of the word actually meant a secretion from a plant. Think of a poppy. And it means intoxicants, the way the Buddha used it. It also means floods, outflows, effluents. But it's got this meaning that the Buddha actually was using, intoxicants. We're intoxicated by sense pleasures. We're intoxicated by wanting to become something. We're intoxicated out of ignorance. Samsara is not a wheel. It's a drunken party in a casino. Our job is to sober up, find the exit, and get out. Okay, let's see. Angulimala was a brigand who killed 999 people. Why was he still eligible for awakening? Because he realized there was something better to do than go around killing other people. All right. He was probably an early follower of Shiva. So he was already on a spiritual quest. And he didn't commit any of the five heinous crimes. He repented and he was interested in the spiritual life. King Ajatasattu was interested in power. Do the jhanas arise naturally out of deep samadhi, or are they something additional and more complex, please? And thank you for a lovely talk. You're welcome. The answer to your questions, they are something additional and or more complex. They can arise out of deep samadhi. I stumbled into the first jhana on my own, not knowing what I was doing, on my second retreat. Okay. When I'm teaching, I'd say 20% of the students have stumbled into the jhanas on their own. You just do good enough meditation and get concentrated, you stumble into one of these states. The fact that I can teach the jhanas isn't because I'm a great teacher. It's because these are states that the human mind likes to fall into. All I'm doing is saying, yeah, this is the trick you do, and your mind will go into this state. There's nothing special about me. It's just that I happen to know what the instructions are so you can fall into these states. So you might fall into them out of deep samadhi, or they might be something that you actually have to learn, but hopefully you can find somebody that can teach them to you. Can you say more about rapture? I find it difficult to relate to this word. Yeah, rapture is not the best translation of PT. I actually prefer glee, but I'm so used to giving this talk using rapture and happiness for PT and Sukha that's what comes out. It was only later that I found the word glee. One of my students pointed out that glee was a better translation of rapture. It's a physical release of uplifting, hopefully happy energy. If you get PT by itself with no Sukha, it's just like sticking your finger in the electrical socket. It's not very pleasant. But if you have enough Sukha mixed in with it, it's an excited release of energy. Why did the Buddha spend time explaining the benefits of the path to someone he knew wasn't going to follow the path? Well, there are a couple of benefits. One, King Ajatasattu actually became a Dhamma protector. They held the first council outside the city of Rajagaha. So the king benefited from it, although he didn't get as far as, the first level of awakening, but he did get some benefit. And remember, Jivaka was there and 500 women of the court. Did any of those 500 women of the court get to the first stage of awakening? Doesn't say anything. Yeah, doesn't say. Maybe, but there was a lot of other people there. What are the asavas? The intoxicants. The intoxicant of sense desire, the intoxicant of becoming. I want to become rich and famous. Or in my next life, I want to become a deva or whatever. And ignorance. Those are the asavas. Sometimes you get a fourth asava, which is sense of self. But that's just part of ignorance. As a follow-up to my prior question, it still seems to contradict other teachings about past transgressions. Milarepa, for example, murdered numerous people. Is the distinction just that the king killed a parent? It seems the Buddha made a godlike decision here. I'm confused. The Buddha didn't make a decision. He's just reporting what's going on. The king is much more interested in secular power. He's not interested at all in the spiritual life, unless it allows him to sleep. He went home and got his first good night's sleep that night, according to the commentaries. That's all he was interested in. He didn't care about awakening or anything like that. He thought, yeah, this Buddha guy, he's pretty good. We'll protect him. But he wasn't interested in the spiritual path. And the Buddha recognized that. The Buddha wasn't making any godlike distinction. He was just noticing, this guy's so power-bent, he killed his father. But Milarepa was interested in spiritual advancement, just like Angulimala, just like all of you. And I'm sure none of you have committed heinous crimes. And if you're serious about the spiritual path, you can make progress. Okay, last chance for questions. If there are none, maybe we should close with some metta. So please put your attention on your breath for a moment. Do you like to be happy? I mean, is it a good thing if you're happy? Can you get in touch with the fact that you enjoy being happy? It's nice to be happy. Yeah, may we all be happy. Do you like it when your friends are happy? I mean, if you go see your friend and they're happy, you like that? Wouldn't it be great if your friends were happy? May all of our friends be happy. What if your family's happy? Oh, yeah, that'd be nice. May our families be happy. What if your acquaintances were happy? What if all your coworkers and neighbors and people you saw in the shops were happy? Wouldn't that be great? Yeah, may all our acquaintances be happy. What if everybody on this planet was happy? What if the difficult people were happy? Well, maybe they wouldn't be difficult. What if everybody was happy? Think about it. What would this planet be like if everybody was happy? I'd sure like to live in a place like that. May all beings everywhere be happy. Thank you for this opportunity to share the Dharma. May you all be happy, and may your journey on the spiritual path be fruitful. Take care.